I believe that we will be past this and it will be in the rearview mirror. And when that happens, I think it will be sort of the beginning of kind of going back to normalcy, and call it within some reasonable period of time after that, a couple of years, it will be back to how it used to be. And I think live events will be in full force again. People will go into sporting events, concerts, and theater events. And not that people will completely forget about this pandemic, but it won't be in the kind of front of everyone's minds.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. I had a chance recently to catch up with Jeff Fleur, the original founder of StubHub. StubHub was just valued at $4.4 billion and was literally sold again right before the pandemic hit. Incredible timing, considering that the entire live events business has been put on hold. It's certainly not a great time for StubHub, so it was really nice to get Jeff's perspective on the business and hear his story on how he grew StubHub himself before he eventually sold the business the first time to eBay for north of $300 million. I knew Jeff from the beginning, and I remember meeting with him early on, when he was literally just starting out. Having started my own business in the sports experience space, I was well aware of Jeff. And over the years, we even worked together with StubHub in different ways, with my company, TSE Sports and Entertainment. But quite honestly, when Jeff started on his venture with StubHub, I knew what he was getting into. With the murkiness of the ticket business and all those laws that were in place to stop secondary ticket sales, I just couldn't put my head around it, how he was going to succeed. It was a tall task, and in the end, he ended up creating one of the first true digital marketplaces. He revolutionized an entire industry by bringing transparency to the market and opportunities to individual fans. To say I was excited to have him on How Success Happens was an understatement. I caught up with Jeff recently. I couldn't wait to hear Jeff's take on live events and experiences, and what he thought the future was going to hold, now and post-pandemic.
Yeah, Robert, thanks for having me today. It's exciting to be reconnected. So yeah, I think StubHub is a pretty strong company and has been the dominant player in the whole ticket resale market for quite a while now. So there's no doubt that the pandemic has had a very substantial negative impact on that whole business, on the whole industry, and on StubHub's business in particular. But I think that from what I sort of see from afar and from what I read, frankly, it sounds like they have a fairly strong balance sheet after the acquisition and will likely be able to weather the storm. They have a strong brand and a strong balance sheet. And I think that will allow them to kind of get through the light at the end of the tunnel and sort of rebuild again, whether that's, you know, a year from now or, you know, 2 years from now. So I do think they will survive.
How do you see, I mean, it's great talking to someone like yourself, especially someone who's such an important entrepreneur to the entire experience economy. How do you foresee, though, events coming back, and how long will it take? Do you think they'll change? Do you think there'll be differences in how you attend an event, even just initially and then long-term?
So let's take the long-term first, because I think in some ways, my opinion there is pretty clear, which is I think that in the long-term, you know, it's going to go back to, you know, how it was. I think that there are a lot of people out there who say the world is forever changed, we're never going back to how it used to be, and all of these kind of fundamental human behaviors are going to be forever transformed. I don't believe that. I think that people have a short memory. I think once there is, you know, once the pandemic is in the rearview mirror, which I believe it will be, because I think that either we will get a vaccine or there will be an effective treatment, or it will just, through other means, it will sort of dissipate to a small, sort of a small level of new virus hospitalizations, and all the metrics will kind of come down. So I believe that we will be past this and it will be in the rearview mirror. And when that happens, I think it will be sort of the beginning of kind of going back to normalcy, and call it within some reasonable period of time after that, a couple of years, it will be back to how it used to be. And I think live events will be in full force again. People will be going to sporting events, concerts, and theater events. And not that people will completely forget about this pandemic, but it won't be in the kind of front of everyone's minds.
Yeah, I think to me that's exactly how I see it. I just know, as you said, humans have short memory, and especially when they feel confident and there is a vaccine or there are different types of medicines, you know, people need experiences. They need to get out there. I felt even more of a need for that. And I can't wait to be able to go to events again. I think that that's really true. And it reminds me a little of like after 9/11, where now we had this situation where it was scared to go to these big stadiums and events. And, you know, you were right in the middle of it when you were starting your business or shortly thereafter or right around that time. And there were changes with security. So for the short term, do you see any types of changes with hygiene and how people are going to enter stadiums, let's say, come the fall?
Yeah. So I think the short term is a little bit, you know, less clear. I think in the very short term, like through the end of 2020, you know, I just don't think there's going to be that many live events, if any. And so I think it's going to continue to be very tough for some of the, you know, any business that's in and around the live events space will be tough, kind of tough road. I think once the events start happening again, I think there's going to be sort of a slow ramp back to kind of the old sort of level of demand and the old sort of attendance types of numbers and sort of demand in the resale market. And the reason I think it'll be a slow ramp is because I think there are some people, young people, who probably would be going to live events today if they were happy. Yeah. And I think there is this dynamic that you sort of touched on of almost like a pent up demand where people haven't been going to live events now for a few months. And there's almost like more interest in it because human nature is you always sort of want what you can't have. Right. And so you sort of miss, there's almost like a nostalgia of live events that's starting to appear. And I think that there will be some segment of the population that will start going to events immediately once the events happen. But I think there's going to be a fairly significant segment that will be more cautious, whether those are people, you know, above the age of 60 or 70 years old, or people who have sort of other types of health conditions or immunocompromised conditions, or just people who are, you know, who are more cautious and who aren't going to be the first ones to show up at, you know, a baseball game or a football game when they are actually being held. And I think that those populations of people that are more cautious will take a while to feel comfortable, and it'll sort of happen over the course of months and frankly years. And that hasn't even started yet, right? That clock hasn't even really started because there really are no live events right now. So I think it's another 6 to 9 months before the live events start happening. And then I think it'll be, call it another year to sort of 3 years before we really get back to the volumes, the demand, the audience attendance kind of numbers that, you know, that we were seeing kind of pre-COVID.
Yeah. And I think just to cap that, I totally agree. And what you just said, I think is exactly right in how it's going to play out. And soon enough, whether it's 2 years or 3 years, the experience business, the events business is going to be back in force. And probably just with all the trends that were happening prior, even with in greater need. And I love hearing that, especially from someone like you, who really understands this business. And I want to go back to a time when you were in Stanford, you're at Stanford, and or maybe it was post after I had met you, and you were really just starting StubHub. And I had been in that business from the experience side, but I knew that business and I knew what you were dealing with from how murky it was and ticket brokers. And I mean, for some people who might not understand because they see StubHub today and think, oh, maybe this is how it always was. You really went into a business. I give you so much credit because it was so murky, as I said, and just backwards and really like how you were able to do that and why you did it. I'd love to hear how did that come about and how'd you take that on? I mean, just initially, and even did you know how bad it was?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. Some people, you know, people say ticket scalping is like the second oldest profession in the world behind you know what.
Right. Yeah.
So it's kind of been around forever, right? People buying and selling tickets, you know, in the secondary market. And you've got this kind of fundamental need that has existed, particularly with season tickets, where people buy, you know, a season ticket package and no one goes to, you know, 81 home games in a baseball season or 40, you know, 41 games in a basketball season. So there are just sort of naturally extra tickets from season ticket holders. And you've got, ticket brokers who oftentimes are finding their own ways of getting tickets, you know, some of the most premium tickets that they intend to resell from the beginning. And so there's this kind of market that's always existed well prior to the internet. And as a kid, I had enjoyed going to concerts. My father was a Yankee season ticket holder. I was never a huge sports fan myself, which a lot of people actually are surprised to hear that.
I love hearing that you were. I never knew that.
I mean, you know, I like going to a game here or there, you know, baseball with my dad or other games, but I was never just like a diehard sports fan like many others. But I had experienced kind of the problems with the existing solutions, the problem of being a season ticket holder and having extra tickets, the problem of wanting to go to an event that was sold out and having to deal with, you know, sort of these ticket brokers or ticket scalpers. And so I had seen some of the, you know, some of the shady characters that were kind of in and around the whole ticket resale business, or the, you know, the guy with the trench coat and the gold watches, you know, selling tickets out of the trunk of his car, you know, kind of right near the stadium on game day. I had experienced that as a buyer, as a seller. And I felt that the internet was just really well suited to kind of start to solve that problem by bringing kind of buyers and sellers together in a more transparent way and really bringing kind of trust and safety to a market that had lacked that sort of consumer trust historically. And at the time when we started StubHub, you know, I was 24, 25 years old at Stanford Business School. And there were a couple solutions out there that people were starting to use online to buy and sell tickets. Really, eBay and Craigslist were the two channels that people were starting to use. But we felt that those channels were still lacking when it came to sort of trust and safety. And eBay's solution to trust and safety was sort of the community regulates itself. If you have a bad experience, you can leave bad feedback and you can look at the seller's feedback to determine if you think they're trustworthy. But beyond that, we're not getting in the middle of it. And Craigslist was even worse. Craigslist was sort of like, there is no feedback, but you can see a posting and you can meet somebody at a coffee shop and hope that they don't screw you over.
Right.
And so we just felt that we could really provide a guarantee really for ticket buyers that would give them peace of mind, that would really help accelerate the volumes in the market and grow the market. And so that was really what the idea for StubHub was. And what we set out to do.
So I know you came up with the business plan while you're at Stanford. And what's the story behind it? I know there's a story in terms of you had a business plan, there's a competition. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So you know, it was really interesting timing, kind of ironic and in some ways terrible timing because I had graduated from college in 1996. I had an engineering degree and a finance degree. I was always interested in technology, but I'd gone the finance route out of school, and but wanted to get more involved in technology. And I went to Stanford, and one of the things that I was hoping to do at Stanford was to sort of start a company and to do it within the kind of internet, you know, the internet space. And part of my influence there was just that, you know, the whole internet was booming at this time. So this was like the late 90s when you had huge growth in companies like Netscape and Amazon and eBay and Yahoo, this kind of first generation of internet companies that had launched, gone public in some cases, and were, you know, kind of their stock prices were kind of going through the roof. And it was a very exciting time for the internet economy. And I was attracted to that, and I wanted to get involved in it and sort of, you know, leverage some of my experience as an engineering student and also just my passion for technology. So at Stanford, you know, in the middle of my first year, one of my classmates and I submitted a business plan for StubHub. There's an annual business plan competition at Stanford. We kind of both had experience with sort of ticket buying and selling. We wrote a 2 or 3 page executive summary. All you needed to do was submit an executive summary to this business plan. It wasn't like a full business plan, but it was like a 2 or 3 page executive summary. We submitted our executive summary and we were selected as one of the 6 finalists. Our business plan was, I think there were like 40 or 50 some odd submissions. We were one of the 6 finalists. The business plan at the time was actually called needaticket.com. We didn't have, the name was still in flux. It was sort of a placeholder name. And we were accepted as one of the 6 finalists, but we decided that we didn't actually want to show up on the day of the final judging. The way the final round worked was the 6 finalists would show up and kind of pitch their idea in person to a panel of VC judges. And then one company would win, and that company would get like a small grant from the university to the tune of, I think it was like $20,000 or $25,000. Right. That was like a non-recourse grant. So it was literally like a grant. It was like non-dilutive, you know, capital.
Right.
And so we just decided we didn't want to show up for that final day because we actually wanted to start the company and our intention was to start the company, which we of course did. And we didn't want to attract more attention to kind of this idea and what we were doing because we felt that, you know, it was like many things in the internet, it was sort of important to, you know, it was the barriers to entry were low until we had built some scale and some critical mass, you know, and had sort of the network effects starting to kick in with supply and demand on the marketplace, which of course becomes a huge barrier to entry once you get there. But actually in the early days, the barriers to entry are fairly low because anybody else could launch a similar marketplace and sort of race to kind of get the critical mass. And so we wanted to sort of stay under the radar screen. We didn't show up for the final round and we incorporated the company in March of 2000. Now, the reason why I said earlier that the timing was so ironic and really bad timing was because March of 2000 was literally like the peak of the internet stock, of the stock in the internet.
The bubble, yeah, where it broke.
The stock market. And what happened in April of 2000, 1 month later, was the entire internet economy kind of blew up and the floor fell out on the internet stocks and all of the stocks, you know, came crashing down 80-90% in, you know, in a matter of a few months. And it kind of went on for, it's really until 2002 before the stock market really started to recover. So it was sort of the beginning of a painful period for internet companies.
Do you think, you know, in terms of that and like money drying up and at that point, and then, of course, you were faced with 9/11 as well. You know, you're starting an events business, and that took a hit from that a little bit. Do you think, looking back, it was a positive for you that maybe, or you know, did it change your business plan at all for StubHub, or did you just focus on what you needed to focus on?
Yeah. So there were a couple things that affected our path for sure because of the internet.com bubble bursting, as well as, you know, 9/11. So what we did as a result of those two changes, we did two things. One was we focused more on a B2B strategy instead of a B2C strategy early on. And that later changed, but that was largely influenced by the dot-com bubble bursting, which at the time, the sort of conventional wisdom said that B2B was slightly better than B2C. And we can kind of go deeper into that. So we ended up focusing on B2B, on a B2B strategy in order to both attract capital that we needed to attract because there was not a lot of capital for kind of B2C businesses at the time.
Right.
And because we thought it would be a better path to success. We later changed that strategy. I think the 9/11 thing, we were so small that, I mean, we were certainly impacted by 9/11 and all live events were, but it's not like we had an existing significant business that then, you know, sank, you know, 70% or whatever because of 9/11. We were just starting to build our business right at that time. So the impact it had on us was in a way probably smaller than the impact it might have had on an existing business that had sort of a stable revenue base. So yeah, so we definitely sort of pursued this B2B strategy as a way to kind of navigate what investors were looking for and what we thought would actually work better for kind of a customer acquisition strategy back in those early days.
Right. Was that B2B strategy, from what I recall, was that liquid seats and what, and can you just explain it to our listeners, like the difference just real quickly, B2C, B2B, and how that works?
Yeah. So yeah, you're right. We actually, in the early days, the name of the company, we had StubHub was kind of a B2C website where you could go to buy and sell tickets. We initially focused just on the Bay Area as a way to sort of isolate the problem and prove it out in a single market. So you could go to StubHub and buy and sell tickets for Bay Area events. But Liquid Seats was the corporate name because we were trying to pursue this B2B strategy, which, you know, business to business strategy, where the idea was that we would power ticket marketplace functionality for other websites, for sports team websites, for media company websites. So we did deals with local radio stations and newspapers, all of whom had their own websites. And we would sort of power that you could buy and sell tickets on like San Francisco Chronicle's website, or on, we did a deal with MSN pretty early on, or a deal with AOL, where you could go to AOL and you could go to the quote AOL ticket marketplace, but it was really all of our
kind of software. Your back end.
And so that's what I mean by B2B. It was kind of these partnership driven marketplaces that really drove our initial usage and kind of where we wanted to focus. And the reason was because at the time, the feeling was it was going to be way too expensive to try to build a consumer brand. Prior to the dot-com bubble bursting, this idea was everybody was trying to sort of aggregate eyeballs. It's like, how many eyeballs do you have? And then once the dot-com bubble burst, the feeling was that, hey, it's way too expensive to build a consumer brand. The idea of building a consumer brand on the internet is never going to happen. It's never going to work. So we sort of subscribed to that theory and bought into that idea. And we built StubHub, which again was called Liquid Seats. We started it off in this kind of B2B partnership driven strategy as a way to not have to spend a ton of our money on building our own brand.
Right. And then I know you went and you focused on B2C and you did do, I mean, tons of branding. And then you even started to get involved, from what I recall, with teams. Can you talk to me how that started? And I think a big pivotal moment may have been the MLB deal.
Yeah. So the first deal we signed with MLB was in like the summer of 2001. So less than a year after the first version of the product was even publicly available. We launched the first version of the product in like October of 2000. By like June of 2001, we had a deal with MLB, which was completely white labeled. And the Seattle Mariners and the Arizona Diamondbacks were the first two teams. And you would go onto the Mariners website and you would go to this thing called like the Mariners Ticket Marketplace, but it was totally powered by us, but you would never have known it. It was just kind of white labeled in that way. And in those early deals, those B2B partnership deals, they were revenue share arrangements. So we would keep a piece of the revenue, we would share revenue with the team. And then in the case of the MLB deal, we also gave some of the revenue to the league. So the league got a piece of the revenue, the team got a piece of the revenue, and then we got a piece of the revenue. But we didn't pay anything for it, right? We didn't pay any upfront money.
Right, it was a revenue share.
Complete. Exactly. So that was how those deals worked in the early days. When we started experimenting with focusing on the consumer site, StubHub, with the advent of paid search. So Google AdWords and Yahoo Overture were the two kind of paid search platforms in the early 2000s. And we started, that sort of became a thing in like 2002-03. And we started experimenting with just buying keywords on like Google AdWords. We could buy, you know, so anytime somebody went in and typed Yankees tickets, you'd see like a StubHub ad. And we realized we could send that traffic directly to the StubHub website and not have to share revenue with anybody.
Right,
we didn't have to share it with the league. We didn't have to share it with the team. And we just kept 100% of the revenue. Now, sure, we were paying for the traffic, unlike the revenue share deals where we didn't have to pay for the traffic, but we were also keeping 100% of the money. And importantly, we were building a brand. We were building awareness for StubHub that had long-term, you know, implications in terms of the long-term value of what that kind of brand equity became. And we'd get repeat usage from those users because they would come back. They would tell their friends. So you had word of mouth, you had repeat usage. And that really started to like build brand equity in the StubHub brand. And as we started to see that this paid search phenomenon allowed us to scale our revenue and control our own destiny. And sort of, even though we were growing pretty nicely with the B2B approach, the opportunity felt much bigger and felt like we could grow much faster just by going kind of direct to consumer with our own brand. So it was around that time, 2003-04, that we sort of said, screw this Liquid Seats thing, screw this B2B strategy. We're just going to focus on StubHub. We're going to focus on the consumer brand. We got rid of the Liquid Seats name. We changed the name of the company to StubHub. All of the deals with the teams from that point forward, we still had deals with teams, but they kind of changed 180 degrees in terms of the economics and also in terms of how we got the deals. When we were doing the revenue share deals, we were trying to partner with like the operations guy or the VP of ticketing or the VP of operations at the team to sort of do this kind of white label ticketing thing.
Yeah.
When we started doing the B2C stuff, we were just dealing with the VP of sponsorships, the VP of sales who was selling sponsorships. Yeah. We were just saying, hey, listen, we'll pay you $500,000. We want the StubHub sign out in outfield. Right. We want to send a mailer to all the season ticket holders and we want to build a StubHub.
You were just
brand.
Like Budweiser or, you know, traditional sponsor looking for exposure as opposed to selling your tickets.
Exactly. And so, it was a much easier sell because that guy had a quota. That guy was like looking to
he
sell.
He loved it.
And it was a brand new category that didn't exist prior to the ticket resale wasn't a thing. But now we were coming in there saying, look, we want to be the exclusive ticket, you know, ticket resale partner. And we want to have signage and we want to mailer to all your season ticket holders and we'll pay you $500,000. So we did pay up front, but we kept 100% of the transaction fees from that point forward. And the economics were just much better in that.
Yeah.
Partly because just the near-term economics were better because we were keeping 100% of the revenue, but also because the long-term economics with the brand and building that awareness really played to our benefit.
Yeah. And I just going back quickly, we'll move on, but to that MLB deal, one thing that I remember when I heard about that, that was really transformative because I had never expected at that time, you know, obviously there was primary sellers and, but at that time when I heard StubHub had a deal with MLB, I was like, you know what? The world's changing. Things are changing. Like if they're going to do a deal with StubHub, were you as surprised at the time?
Yeah. You know, and I think one of the things you're touching on is that the ticket resale market has been stigmatized, right? And prior to StubHub, it was really stigmatized. People, you know, and we talked a little bit about the sort of shady characters dealing with selling tickets, buying tickets with the, you know, out of the trunks of their cars. And so, and a lot of the people in the business of sports, a lot of the people in the front office of sports teams and the leagues would say that they didn't like the resale of tickets. But the irony, of course, in many cases is that lots of them were sort of involved. They were profiting from the ticket resale market. They were selling tickets to their buddy, Vinny, the broker. And so like they would say one thing, but they would sort of do another in many cases. But certainly it was the public, what they would say publicly was that they didn't like it and they thought it was bad. And there was this idea that buying a ticket for more than the face value was somehow morally or ethically wrong. Even though every other product in the entire world, you can buy or sell at whatever price you want. If you have an old Ferrari and you want to sell it for twice of what its original cost was, that's fine. If you have a house and you sell it for more than you bought it for, that's fine. But if you have a ticket and you try to sell it for more than what you bought it for, somehow like you become the devil, right? And so that's how it used to be. Honestly, there's still some of that today in certainly in some geographies, especially outside the US, but even in the US, some people have that perspective. I think what we tried to do was we tried to educate people in the business of sports. We tried to educate consumers. We tried to educate legislators, people in the government that were making laws because it was illegal in some states, right? So there was this kind of patchwork of state laws that existed where some states it was completely legal to do whatever you wanted to. From the federal government's perspective, you could sell a ticket for $1 billion if you want to. It wasn't illegal. And many states also had no restrictions, but a patchwork of states did have restrictions and it was different in every state. It was difficult to understand. And there were a bunch of questions around jurisdiction, but we tried to educate people that, look, it's in everybody's interest that these tickets are sort of freely tradable in the secondary market. It's in the team's interest. They can fill seats instead of having no shows. They make more money from all the per cap revenue from hot dogs and pizza and beer and parking. It's in the fans' interest because both the seller, the season ticket holder, or even one-off sellers, they need to get rid of their tickets. They shouldn't have to lose that money. And then for the buyers, it's in their interest because if you try to choke the secondary market by making it illegal, the prices are actually higher. The few tickets that are available that are being sold by people who are effectively breaking the law are that much higher because they're taking on more risk. There's fewer of them. And so you have less supply, more demand. You have higher ticket prices. If you just let the price, the tickets flow freely, sure, you may have some tickets that trade above face value. You may have some that trade below face value. But whatever the price is, it'll be indicative of the real market value price as opposed to some elevated price that's higher than the fair market value because of all these restrictions. So we tried to educate people around those issues. And we were successful in some cases. We changed the laws in a handful of states with some lobbying efforts. But I think we also started to change the perception among the sports teams and among fans. And yeah, we were able to get some forward-thinking people. It was really a guy at the Seattle Mariners who sort of, this was when like Ichiro Suzuki was like playing there. And they were like a really good team right around that 2000.
Yeah, right around there. They were great.
And they had a ton of demand for their tickets, right? And so there was a VP of technology there who was like, yeah, we should totally do this. We want a piece of this secondary market. And he was sort of forward thinking. He was like, yeah, we'll try this. We're going to put this on our site. We're going to white label it. And I was like, great. And so we did. Yeah. And so they then, but the way that the Major League Baseball Advanced Media worked then, and I think still works today, the league sort of has to kind of, unlike some of the other leagues in baseball, the league has to sort of approve stuff like that.
Yeah. That's still the way.
So it had to get kicked up to the league. The league like listened to us and they were like, sure, we'll do this. And we did a deal with the Mariners and slowly we chipped away at more and more teams after that.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors. We all know that the work you do matters, no matter where you do it from. And nowadays, we are all doing it from a lot of different places. The good news is, I know a trusted company called WebEx. WebEx provides simple and reliable video communication tools that will allow you and your team to connect and collaborate securely. WebEx can take care of business anywhere you are. And no one doing business right now can afford to have their video conference bombed or their privacy compromised. WebEx is perfect as it allows you to work remotely and, most importantly, securely. When it comes to remote work from home and you need to get stuff done and security matters, you can definitely trust WebEx. Look, I know there are heads of state, governments, schools, hospitals that all trust WebEx. It is definitely my choice for secure video conferencing and collaboration. Oh, and another thing I love about WebEx, WebEx can do virtual happy hours and weddings too. That's right, hashtag life on WebEx. So if you can imagine it, WebEx can build the bridge to get you there.
And we're back. That was revolutionary. And you touched on a point, like people back then, it was this misperception of tickets and why it was the only, you know, product that you couldn't sell for more. It always felt, and I think a lot of the politicians played it up where they knew really what was going on, but it made them look good if they were going to hold ticket prices down, and you just couldn't do it. Brokers were selling it anyway. What you guys were doing was making it all transparent, which was the best thing for everyone. And now looking back in hindsight, you were exactly right. And that's what has happened in terms of the ticketing market. And I even look at it now with season tickets, and there is no reason to have season tickets anymore because what StubHub did and presented and now. And that was kind of what your original premise was, which makes total sense. How much of, again, going back to the legalities, when you got into it and start, did you even understand the magnitude of laws and how much time you would probably have to spend talking to politicians and trying to change laws? And would that have changed your mind about jumping into this business?
Yeah, so interestingly, it was the very first thing we did. But before we raised an outside round of capital in the summer of 2000, which is, I think we raised the first round in August of 2000. So between kind of February when we wrote the business plan and the business plan competition and August when we raised a small $500,000 round from kind of friends and family, in that 4 or 5 month time frame, we actually hired a law firm, a regulatory-focused law firm based in Washington, D.C., a law firm called Wiley, Ryan & Fielding, which is a great law firm that really does a lot of regulatory work. We hired them to do a survey of all the laws. We knew there were no federal laws, but we wanted to look at the different states and the state laws, and even in certain municipalities, there are laws. And so we wanted to sort of like peel the onion on these laws and try to figure out how we could set up StubHub so that at a minimum, we could make a strong argument as to why, you know, it was completely legal. And so that's what they did. They got equity in StubHub for doing it. And they didn't, I don't think they charged us any cash. And at the end, they're making a bunch of money on
that. That was actually a really smart play, I'll tell you. Doesn't usually work out like that, but it did for them.
I'm still in touch with the partner over there who did the work. He now runs the firm. But yeah, I mean, it was key to what we were doing because regulated industries, at the time we started StubHub, it wasn't yet kind of cool to go into a regulated industry and kind of push the envelope. Yeah. It has since become kind of en vogue to do that. You've got Uber and Airbnb, which are two of the most successful unicorns of the last decade that have done that, right? They both of them have business models that are pushing up against, you know, local and state laws. And so people, I think, now realize when you go into a business where you're kind of in a little bit of a gray area from a regulatory perspective, there actually can be some pretty big positives to starting a company in a regulated market, so long as you don't want to be completely in the black, but you don't necessarily need to be completely in the white either. So you can't go start a company selling cocaine and say, well, it's regulated, so I'm not going to do that, right? That's not what I mean. But what I mean is, if you're doing right by consumers, if you fundamentally are helping the consumer out and it's not, then just because there's some antiquated laws that were written before the internet that didn't really contemplate how this world that we currently live in would operate, doesn't mean you shouldn't, shouldn't go into that market. And so, and I think that's become more clear over the last 10 years. When we were doing it, you know, it wasn't as clear. And so we knew that there was this regulatory environment, but we felt very confident that it was in consumers' best interest for there to be a safe and trusted open market for tickets that, you know, where people could buy and sell tickets to events. And that was kind of That's what we did.
Yeah. And you know what? That really makes sense when you say that, just it was fighting the good fight, because at the end of the day, this was for the benefit of general consumers. And, you know, looking back and seeing those laws, you kind of shake your head. So thankfully you guys went through that, put a lot of time into it, and now had the opportunity to build this incredible business. And looking at it, taking it to the point, I guess you were about 7 years in and you decided to sell the business. Can you tell us a little bit about that and sell it to, most people know here, eBay? But how did that all come about? And was that something you wanted to do? Was it something, you know, a little bit of taking something off the table, a little bit of getting out of the industry? What was on your mind and how come you did that deal? Aside from them throwing tons of money at you, which is always nice.
Yeah. So it was, I think I sold StubHub when I was, you know, 31 years old. My wife.
That's pretty amazing. Wife. Just when you think about, you know, getting older now in life and 31 and 300 and some odd million dollars. That's especially for someone like you who started in really like hands-on, like hand-to-hand combat, that it's got to make you feel good, but go on with your story.
It was great. I mean, StubHub was a great experience and I learned a lot, and, you know, and exiting it was, was a big part of that. I think in retrospect, you know, I sold StubHub too early, and it's now recently traded earlier this year at a $4 billion valuation. So it's now worth, you know, quite a bit more than it was when I sold it. And it continued to grow a lot after I sold it. And I think that is what it is. So yeah, I mean, to your question, my wife was pregnant with our first kid. He's now 13 years old.
Is that the picture of him right behind you there? It looks like as a baby.
No, well, there's.
It's like it's got to be 13 years old.
This guy.
Yeah, this is him.
So my wife was pregnant. I had been doing it for 7 years. The job got sort of less exciting for me the bigger the company got. So when, you know, we had 400 and something employees when I sold the company. Yeah. I really liked the sort of early stage, roll up your sleeves and sort of, you know, scrappy startup environment, and was kind of less interested in managing a bunch of VPs and sort of doing the kind of administrative things that kind of start coming into the role. And, you know, and I just was having less fun. And, you know, I was, my first kid was about to be born, and eBay was pretty aggressive about wanting to buy the company. And I was in favor of exiting at that time, and it worked out well. I think now, as we talked about at the beginning, if you look at what's happening now with the live events business, given COVID, in some ways it'd be a very tough time to, you know, to be sort of running that company today, because it is such a devastating time period for them.
Do you think it opens up the opportunity now because it's just such a devastating time, but does it open up the opportunity now for others? And I know there have been others since you started StubHub. Is it a reset moment, or do you think just at this point it's just going to play out and they'll be back on top pretty soon?
You know, I think it probably is a bit of a reset moment. And as you touched on, you know, there are a number of other companies that have done really well, particularly in the last, you know, 5 years. Companies like Vivid Seats and Game Time SeatGeek, you know, have all kind of made their mark in this space. You know, and one of the things that I say in a blog post that I wrote a couple of weeks ago about, you know, starting companies in periods like this, just more generally speaking, is that there are some actual big advantages to starting a company when the market's kind of in a downturn. And one of those advantages is that there's generally less startups that are getting funded, right? There's less competition. There's also more talent available. You can hire great people because there have been so many layoffs of great companies, including companies like Uber and Airbnb that are laying off, you know, really talented people. So you have access to better talent. You have less competition. The one thing that is tougher, and it's material, is raising capital. Raising capital gets tougher, but a lot of other things actually get easier in a time like this. So you take that dynamic plus the fact that there is a bit of a reset, right? The fact that all of these companies have zero revenue right now, right? Yeah. Whether all the companies we just mentioned have zero revenue. In a way, that hurts StubHub more than it hurts everybody else, because StubHub was the biggest. They had the farthest to fall. So they're all sort of at the same size right now. Their size is zero, right? Where StubHub was the biggest, and now they're all at zero. So I think it is sort of a reset, and it does sort of give an opportunity for other companies to kind of potentially elbow their way into a leadership position in a post-COVID world when events start coming back. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I do think that there are some other dynamics that affect that going on. For example, you may have read that there have been some lawsuits around these refunds. StubHub changed their policies. They had so many requests for refunds, yeah. And they're not the only ones, right? I mean, this isn't just affecting StubHub, but they've got, because of the policy changes, they've sort of, I think it's started to hurt their brand a little bit, yeah. Where they've said, look, we used to have this fan protect guarantee where we would give everybody a refund if there was any problem. But guess what? Now with COVID, we're changing that policy. We're only going to give you kind of credit towards a future purchase, because they couldn't physically afford to pay all of those refunds back. So things like that, I think, can really hurt their brand. And that's the one thing that StubHub has, really, I think, that, you know, is a long-term value driver for them, is the brand. So if they start to make decisions that affect their brand negatively, I think that only accentuates the point that we said earlier, which is that it is sort of a reset, which kind of levels the playing field here and gives everybody an equal opportunity, all of the players in the space, and maybe even some new company that doesn't yet exist that has some new angle. This would be a great time to kind of try something new in the ticket resale market, because everybody's at zero. So you kind of come back at the same level playing field that everybody else is at.
Yeah, I love that. I love how you put that. That's exactly right, just in terms of thinking about it and what's going on. And it is amazing to think, when you started, there weren't many other ticketing companies, and now just how many I've seen come and go and talk to people who are starting ticket companies. I just literally got a deck from a couple kids from Wesleyan the other day about starting a ticketing company where you're selling tickets in stadium, you know, during, like, it's great to see, like, opening the doors. I think you and StubHub really opened the doors for that. But going back to saying, you know, you sold it in 2007, and I want to get current with what you're doing now, but you took off a few years. Was that, you know, about your wife was pregnant, you had your first child, but was that hard? Someone like you, who's like this, you know, roll up the sleeves operator entrepreneur, was that a difficult time for you, or were you okay with that?
You know, it's funny, like I didn't actually expect to take off as much time as I did. I ended up taking off like 3 years. And I think I did do some things during that 3 years. Like, I did a lot of angel investing, and I invested in a lot of startups, some of whom did really well, but I wasn't working, you know, kind of in a full-time job for 3 years. I originally thought it might be a year or so. And, you know, I started playing golf and playing tennis and doing other kind of hobbies that I was interested in. And my kid was born. So I had literally a newborn kid for the, you know, first, yeah, kind of 2 years. And then we had a daughter who was born, now 10 years old. So it just, we were kind of in this like little kids, you know, zone. And we were doing, my wife and my little kids and I were traveling a lot, and it just kind of went on for 3 years, and it was fun. And then I kind of got into the entrepreneurial game again, but it wasn't actually hard. It was kind of fun and relaxing. I had been driving pretty hard for the 7 years when I was, yeah, running StubHub, and it was kind of like all encompassing, and it was kind of good to take a break. I recommend that for people who kind of have an exit and have the opportunity to do that. So it wasn't too hard, but, you know, I do like to work, and I'm working again now.
Yeah. I want to talk about that moving ahead to now. And you, I saw you're now at, or a partner with Craft Ventures. You can explain it, but what I noticed about it, it looked like a VC shop, but with the three partners, yourself included, which I don't think I've seen or what, but I loved it. It seemed like you guys all have, or have had, that starter, you know, you all started businesses, you operated them from kind of start to exit. Can you tell us a little bit about Craft and what you're looking at now with your investing?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. So Craft is an early stage venture firm. We're based in San Francisco. We invest in, you know, seed A and B rounds of startups. All of the companies we invest in have software development as kind of a core competency. So they're all involved in building software-based products, whether that be websites or mobile apps or, you know, SaaS businesses or marketplace businesses. They all are kind of building software products. Beyond that, you know, it's a pretty broad mandate. So we invest in sort of different industries, different business models, as long as the company is building software. You're right that I think probably the most important thing to think about with Craft is that our ethos is really all about founders backing founders. So all of the partners at Craft have been founders of companies that, you know, went on to be unicorn companies. So I, of course, started StubHub, which we spent a bunch of time talking about. My partner, David Sachs, founded Yammer, which was a company that was acquired by Microsoft for over $1 billion, and was also on the founding team at PayPal, which, yeah, sort of obviously has that sort of halo reputation in the startup world with the PayPal mafia. He was a key part of that.
Yeah.
And my other partner, Bill Lee, started a company called Remark, which was a kind of an early version of Reddit that was acquired by Critical Path, and was involved in the founding of a company called Big Fish Games, which is in the social mobile game space. It's still around and recently traded hands in the billion-dollar range. And then we have a fourth partner, a venture partner named Sky Dayton, who started Boingo and Earthlink, which are two internet access providers. He's also one of the founders of, a co-founder of Cloud Kitchen, which is in the kind of online ordering space for food delivery. And so all four of us have been, you know, really spent most of our careers as founders of companies. So we really are kind of founders first before anything else. We also have done a lot of angel investing among the four of us. And so really when David and Bill founded the firm in 2017, they sort of, you know, it was really about this idea of founders backing founders and taking their angel investing and sort of institutionalizing it at Kraft. And then I joined in 2018. And then we're very active investors. We're currently investing out of our second fund. It's a $500 million fund. We're looking for great entrepreneurs to back. I spend a lot of time personally in marketplaces because of my experience at StubHub. Sure. And so we all try to focus on areas that we know intimately from our entrepreneurial experience. So, you know, I spent 7 years building StubHub. I understand marketplaces, and I try to spend a lot of my time on, you know, marketplace businesses as well as kind of e-commerce business, you know, e-commerce related businesses. David Sachs spends a lot of time in SaaS and consumer businesses, particularly if there's like a viral element, like PayPal and Yammer both had sort of a viral element. Bill Lee spends a lot of time on sort of emerging areas like esports or virtual celebrities or anything in like sort of pop culture, media, entertainment kinds of things. So that's kind of collectively what we do. And yeah, it's been great. It's been a lot.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I mean, just saying that, talking about, you know, marketplaces and with StubHub being one of the original ones, I recently had a guest on, guy Josh Luber, who started StockX, which is a sneaker marketplace. And I laughed when right before the interview or he had stepped down and he brought in the CEO or the president currently, Scott Cutler from StubHub. And I was just like, this makes perfect sense. And it really, when I was talking to him, I probably even mentioned the podcast, it totally reminded me of you in terms of building this marketplace and kind of the same things that you went through. And it's so relevant. So were you one of the original marketplaces? Was there any other marketplaces really at that time that you could kind of look to as opposed to people today who can kind of look at StubHub?
I mean, it was really eBay, right? So eBay was very much like a horizontal platform for sort of buying and selling products of any type. And so what we were, I think, one of the first to kind of come in with this idea, and StockX is a great example in sneakers, and you have Etsy and others that have kind of built great businesses over the course of the last couple of decades. I think with eBay though, I mean, it was, at the time we were starting StubHub, eBay was, you know, a great example and a great kind of company for us to look up to and for us to emulate. And we did try to take a lot of learnings and lessons from the eBay playbook to apply to what we were doing. And we had different advisors and employees who joined our team who had some experience at eBay that, you know, also kind of helped us. But we felt strongly that both a verticalized focus as well as this kind of trust and safety guarantee were, you know, huge differentiators from what they were doing.
Well, Jeff, I wanted to thank you for giving us your time today. Such a pleasure for me, especially remembering back in the day when you were just getting going with StubHub. You still look like 27, so, you know, at least you got that going for you right now. But I wanted to thank you for coming on today. It's totally been a pleasure reminiscing about your success.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Robert. And I mean, given your roots in the events industry and the ticketing world, you know, it is fun to talk about. And you know, it's great to see you again after it's got to be, you know, I guess we probably first connected, you know, probably close to 20 years ago.
Yeah, I remember coming and sitting down with you at the offices of Allen and Company, and they must have been one of your early investors, or then maybe those ticket summits. And it got to give it to you, because I remember going through that and being like, wow, if this guy pulls this off, that, like, and again, I just want to stress that for younger people like Gen Zs and thinking about, it was a different world with tickets. It wasn't easy what you did, but it's a great thing you did it. And I'm really happy for you. And I wish you continued success at Kraft, and I'm sure you'll fund some great marketplaces, and we'll see some more of you.
Awesome. All right, Robert. Well, thanks so much. And I wish you luck as well. And definitely stay in touch.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.